we've thought of states in the West, we've thought of states for the last several hundred years as being democratic.
Thought of past tense.
Yes. And now capitalism and totalitarianism are not in conflict. They mm-hmm. can work quite well together.
I also think of this topic of social pressure as being something that is often in the way of the truth.
There's an uncontrolled burn tearing down existing institutions right now. Some new society and civilization on the other side of this, what remains to be seen is what it is. Government as priest, government as police, government as censor. And then I think the Dark Forest era is something different.
Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is Yancey Strickler, an author and entrepreneur. He is a co-founder of Kickstarter, the director and co-founder of Metalabel, and the author of The Dark Forest Theory of the Internet. What is the Dark Forest Theory of the Internet?
Well, I think I have to go back to what I was feeling at that moment. 2019 is Trump won era.
Yep.
And
pre-pandemic.
Yeah. And it was within the post 2016 hangover where I think a lot of internet people, internet native people had seen the future. The future belongs to us. The future will follow these extremely classic liberal values. And, you know, the future stretches out before us uninterrupted. And I participated in those games. I always had a mixed feelings about them, but I pursued that. And then I gradually retreated and I really stopped trying to stand out in those spaces. And instead I was trying to actually not stand out. I was more doing the opposite. And at the time I had a tiny letter, which was like a precursor to Substack, had about 300 people on it. And so I wrote an essay where I tied some of the ideas from The Three Body Problem by Xixin Liu, the science fiction, hard sci-fi book. And in particular, the way he writes about Fermi's paradox, which is this notion of whether there's other life in the universe. And the idea goes that we look into space, we look into the cosmos, we send signals out into the cosmos saying, hey, we're here. And no one writes back to us at Earth. That leads us to assume that we're the only ones in the universe. After all, why wouldn't anyone else write back? But instead, think of a dark forest at night. It also seems empty. You call out, nothing calls back. But the truth is the dark forest is full. It's just all the animals have learned it's too dangerous to show yourselves because the predators will come out. And so a dark forest, a quiet universe, may actually be a full one, but one of just full of threat. And I felt like that metaphor, that experience really resembled how I felt online, that I didn't want to show myself. To show myself made me vulnerable. You know, early internet, being vulnerable was like a way to get big. That was Tumblr logic, vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And instead, being vulnerable now just made you actually vulnerable to trolls, to all sorts of things. And instead, I was just being my real self in group chats with my friends where, if I had like a banger joke, it wasn't gonna go viral. But also there wasn't that overhead of who may be seeing this that might have a different interpretation of what I'm trying to say, or, you know, just what could go wrong is more limited. So I just expressed that emotion and the way that I was trying to wrestle with it. And I saw problems with this too. I saw problems with this retreat. And I wrote it as a little essay sent to 300 friends, and it ended up breaking containment, ironically, for that piece. And, you know, it was maybe a million reads at this point and became part of like core internet language.
There's videos on YouTube with multiple million views on the topic.
Yeah. But it all just came from, why do I no longer feel safe in the place that I thought liberated me.
Right.
And my experience was not unique. And it's something that a lot of us recognize. And I think we're in a different era of the internet, in a large part because of those emotional forces.
These media conversations that sound rather abstract can be very quickly transposed onto the political models of the influence of legacy media. So I think the subtext of what we're talking about here also revolves around, you know, the audience of the New York Times versus Joe Rogan, for example, and the influence of podcasts in the last election and all of these things. So it's a kind of very quick one-to-one there. There's a tweet that I'm going to paraphrase. I don't remember who wrote it, but something to the effect of, if you get a few dozen likes, you've posted a tasteful banger. And if you get thousands of likes, you've posted slop. That the incentives of the Web 2 internet are not good for quality content. Did you ever feel audience captured by the people that you were writing for?
No, I like that kind of cope, though. Of, you know, it's, no one liked it. That's maybe the best thing I've ever done. Yeah, totally. I certainly tried, like, I got to post every week. I got to, you know, I got to follow the methods that I see work. And yeah, I was trying to do that. And it was, you know, for me, it wasn't real.
Yeah.
I was filling a box. I was filling a rectangle.
Yeah.
Rather than really expressing. Certainly, I had a decade of being the Kickstarter guy online.
Yeah.
Always the most visible of the founders and just really embodied that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I call that audience capture as like corporate capture or, you know, careerism, but certainly that's something you keep in mind. But these days, there are times where I personally will feel so unconvinced by my own bullshit that if someone really likes it, I'm like, oh, there must be something wrong with you. Like, you're not, you're an idiot like me. Then. There's, you know, it's just all internal, internal reckoning.
Practically speaking, what do we mean when we talk about a dark forest community? Where do you find these places? Where are they hosted? How do you join one?
Yeah, it's a gated chat somewhere. It could be an iMessage, WhatsApp, Telegram, Discord, you know, Signal, lots of different places, but they are quick hit spaces where there's some sort of bouncer mediating who gets inside.
A gatekeeper.
Yeah, a gatekeeper.
Oh, wow.
Generally, a kind of a free for all within them. Mm. You know, it's a lot of shit posting and randomness with occasional dives into something more serious if something sparks. I'm a member of many such groups. The theory of the dark forest makes it sound like an enclosed space where light does not enter or exit. In truth, it's just a conspiracy zone. It's a space to have ideas, to build on ideas with each other without any consequence or outcome, unless you explicitly decide to create one. I'm in a chat with like 150 artists, and very active. Many of us are dropping new work all the time on social channels. There is an implicit, unstated, but implicit rule in the chat that you don't post your own releases in the chat.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You don't self-promote your own things. Because everybody's doing it, but someone else can post your thing in the chat and everyone will be like, hey, way to go, you know? Yeah. But you can't because this is a space not for being careerist and corporate. This is a space to be real. And I find in those rooms, people are way more honest about their experiences. Outside, they'll be like, oh, you know, it's the greatest thing ever. And then the chat, they're like, that was a nightmare. Don't work with this person. Yeah, this is like a bad offer. You don't think about that. And there's such a duality because ClearNet, those are commercial spaces. Everything on social media is an ad.
Can we define ClearNet?
Yeah, ClearNet, the social channels, open social networks, Instagram, Twitter, all these things, TikTok.
Big ad-driven social media.
Yeah, those are stadiums, big spaces where anyone can stand up and yell something. Those are the dominant spaces that are around us. And in contrast with these dark forests, these more, you know, shielded zones. But within those dark forests, people are conspiring about how to operate within ClearNet.
Yeah.
You know, how to manipulate attention in some cases. Like if you look at what the most sophisticated like GRU operations or like meme coin pump schemes, it's creating a lot of fake accounts and getting them to all share the same thing and create the illusion of an emerging truth and consensus.
Yeah.
Well, that same strategy can be used by actual people to create actual consensus on things that they believe or just want other people to believe. So you can plot something in a dark forest and then on ClearNet execute that plan without anyone knowing that a plot is happening. And so those are the sorts of dynamics that that you see in those spaces, that's probably them at their most like conniving or, you know, most strategic. But in a lot of cases, it's just a space to be more honest and more real. So for me as a media consumer, like, I will look to mainstream media for certain like factual information, like here is the latest unemployment number or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I have a hard time putting much faith or credence into anything I see in those spaces because I think, well, this is what has been approved for me to know or like someone wants me to know.
Right.
But what obviously feels more valuable to me are what are things that someone doesn't want me to know? And in the past couple of years, I've published a few things just making a Google Doc and leaving the Google Doc open, leaving comments on, and just passing the link to people and saying, don't post this on ClearNet, but you can pass this to friends. Mm. You know, but this is like a private idea. I don't want to get shit around this. I just want to, other people might be interested. Those things get shared so far and wide because it feels like private information.
Yeah.
Private information is more trustworthy today than what we see in these big spaces because everything in ClearNet is an ad. It's an ad for, you know, my social standing. It's an ad for a political cause. It's an ad for a commercial venture. Everything that we see is an ad. And so for me, I have to go into these other private spaces to feel like I'm hearing anything real. And that is also where I am the most real.
What is the post individual?
Yeah, that's a phrase. The post individual is a phrase meant to encompass the way that the internet has changed individuality, what it means to be a person. Who you were as a person was defined by what you looked like, where you were born, who your family was, some basic things that were pretty unchangeable. Mm. The internet allows us to become re-individualized. When we go online, we are creating a new self, a distinct self, different from who we are here. And our internet selves are liberated from all of those physical, familial, geographic constraints. And they invite us to say, well, who are you? Who do you want to be? Who am I really? And that process has proved to be extremely profound and has ultimately remade all of society because the internet has taught us that we actually have many micro-selves within us. All these little thin slices, you know, these prosciutto slices of who we are, you know, the part of me that loves the NBA, the part of me that loves certain types of literature, the part of me, you know, and each of those, all together, the amalgamation of them is, yeah, some form of who I am, but they can also be created into like distinct identities.
Yeah.
And what's happened online is that all of our slices of self are interacting with the slices of self of other people in these chat rooms, in these spaces, in the ClearNet, in dark forests, and they're creating new societies that is overtaking the world that we've come from. And so to think of any of us as just being an individual, what we see in front of us, I think doesn't fully encompass what it is to be a person today. And that to be a post-individual is like a next step in individualism where it's like, yes, I am this person you see in front of me, and I'm ultimately defined by all of these relationships I have with these different communities, these different ideologies. And these are things that really only come about online. That's where we really see them. There's a historian that I can't read enough of, Eric Hobsbawm. Hmm. He's an English historian, wrote all throughout the 20th century, these sweeping histories of everything. And he writes a series of books that go from 1780, which is precursor to French Revolution, and they end in 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union. And there's four books that cover the span of time. Absolutely tremendous. The Age of is the series. And at the end of the book, and that ends in 1991, he says, this is clearly the end of the short 20th century, is the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War.
Right.
And clearly we're poised for some new society and civilization on the other side of this. What remains to be seen is what it is. He wrote this in 1992.
French Revolution up until the fall of the Soviet Union. That's like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's disagreeing with Fukuyama.
Well, 1993 is the internet. What is the new thing that emerges? It is the internet. The internet emerged as the new infrastructure for society. And that is the age that we are in now. And it is breaking down classic nationalist walls. It is creating something like the multinational corporate state,
right,
yet as like a social form, and is truly a new era of history in a way that we can feel in some ways, but is much grander than anything that we can perceive. And this is what the internet has done. It's broken us out of this world where we had defined relationships, and it's just set us out on our own in this new universe where, yeah, what your community is, what your identity is, where does you belong is completely up for grabs. It's for you to define. It's for someone to capture you at the right moment. It's for a certain community to make you feel seen in a way that others have not. And that is what is remaking all of society now. And in this piece, The Post-Individual, I specifically write about when individualism as a concept emerged. And it was around 1000 to 1200 AD. There's two great books, The Weirdest People in the World and The Invention of the Individual, that track this period of time. And around 1000 to 1200 AD, the Catholic Church was fighting for power among these family clans in Europe. At that point, all power was clan-based. And the Catholic Church wanted to break this power. And the idea they ended up coming up with to doing it was they issued a decree that said you are no longer allowed to marry first cousins to each other. At the time, these clans would preserve power by intermarrying within the clan, keep the power in, you know, your children or your resources, like make more.
Wealth preservation.
Keep them all in. Catholic Church says, no, you will be excommunicated if you do that. Can't do that anymore. And within about a generation, this society changed because now you needed a place where you could meet non-cousins. And these new, how many times you got on a Friday, I need to meet a non-cousin tonight.
Yeah.
Where are we going? And so these new social institutions arose. And within 100 years of the prohibition of cousin marriage, three institutions emerged in way bigger ways, or newly. Cities. There were not many cities before then. The cities were quite small. Cities expanded hugely. Guilds and universities all came into existence immediately after the prohibition of cousin marriage, because what happened was people were now liberated from their clans. They were going to these trading posts, which became cities, to look for others. And they struggled without a shared context. They were vulnerable. They needed a way to like find a job. Where do you go to meet people? How do I learn to trade? You know, how do I find my way? And so human beings organically produce these institutions to serve that. I believe that's what's happening on the internet today. That as we started, you know, going onto AOL or CompuServe, you know, in the 90s and re-individualizing ourselves, there's a lot of fun and exploration. We also became a more dangerous place over time, and we learned, you know, the dark forest lessons. And now we're in a period of building the shared institutions that bring us context, meaning, safety, let us find love, let us not feel under threat. And we're iteratively building those things on the web right now. And I believe the foundations of society for hundreds of years, I don't know how long it will last, are going to be based on these sort of internet values in this world that has emerged since 1993. And initially, you know, we had the John Perry Barlow, like it's just utopia. We had that mindset of what the internet would be.
We are trying to escape the industrial nations of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a, you know, I vibe with that.
What is it called?
The
Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace?
Yes. And then I think the Dark Forest era is something different. Mm. And even to bring it back to Hobsbawm, I've come to think that that period of, say, 1789, the French Revolution, to say 2024 even, might represent a distinct period of time of the public nation state.
Right.
And we might be entering a period of the private state.
Right. For people who do not follow this as closely as we do, there are literal projects now to build governance and state-like structures, either in the cloud or on blockchain or things like this. Balaji Srinivasan is the author of The Network State. We talked about him on a recent episode. But I take these things very seriously.
Yeah, multinational corporations paved the way.
Yeah.
You know, things like pay the Portuguese government $250,000 to live there and have a EU passport are not dissimilar.
Right.
And now it's going online. Yeah. And now it's going to spread in a much bigger way.
On this topic of the post-individual, there was a profile of Caleb Kane that was published in the New York Times. I believe this was back in maybe 2019, something like that. I guess around the time that you wrote the Dark Forest essay. But Caleb's YouTube history, we talked to him on an early episode of the show. He had two different accounts, and the data from those accounts of what he viewed and when is made visible in this article. And I always reference back to this because people miss this very important point, that when he was transitioning between belief systems, he was watching both left-wing and right-wing YouTube together for a long time. Not just like, oh, today I'm a democratic socialist and tomorrow I'm a paleoconservative. It was like there's a gradation between, and there's different parts of you, there's different facets with which these worldviews are appealing or resonating. And I think that that's actually the case for pretty much everyone. It's only his YouTube history that's visible at all. But we all have these kind of secret, different facets of ourselves and different communities in which we're resonating with different ideas. And doing so many of these in-depth interviews, especially among young people, but also true for adults, people have totally incoherent, all over the place. You know, they're not centrist, but they're extreme positions from all over the map. Average out into the center.
Yeah.
So it's a very complicated thing when you get really in the weeds with these things.
I mean, when life is a performance, performing in group becomes critically important, and breaking the group becomes extremely risky. Yeah. And this is how social governance is generally structured, you know, peer pressure. You know, we right now, at the start of Trump 2, you know, we're definitely in a big reordering of what is in-group and out-group. And there's a funny energy where a lot of powerful people are revealing themselves to either have had no actual convictions in the past.
Yep.
Or simply that their convictions just mirror whatever is convenient for their own power and self-interest.
Right.
And, you know, we're in a moment where that's being celebrated.
I also think of this topic of social pressure as being something that is often in the way of the truth. So I'll give an example of what I mean for this. Let's imagine someone like Caleb who's watching many different political channels. I've talked to dozens of people who have this experience. I'll share my own in this case, so I'm not doxing anybody else's story. But I would listen to, when I was working the night shift as a freelancer, I would go through the entire archive of the Mises Institute, all of these libertarian lectures. I don't know why I did this to myself, but I absorbed a lot of that information. And there were certain things that made sense, that they were argued coherently. They would leave information out. I disagree with their policy prescriptions, but they would say something that was empirically true. And a part of me resonated with that. And then several years later, I then found the work of David Schweikart, who's a market socialist, and was later able to confirm that, well, in fact, some of those arguments that were coming from Milton Friedman are in fact correct, but here's what he leaves out. And if I had followed the social pressure of the people that I was adjacent to and talking with every day, I would have lost this kernel of information that, although is shrouded with a whole bunch of other bad ideas, is in fact true and is useful for the transitional society that we might want to achieve my fully automated luxury socialist utopia or what have you. But I think that those things are actually very important. And so acknowledging them is also part of the key to shifting these weird political coalitions that seem entirely dysfunctional right now.
For sure. Truth is not what makes you comfortable.
Right.
Truth is not what affirms your beliefs. And that's a different category. You know, and again, in a world where you're born into places, like that is what happens, but the internet, you know, breaks that.
Right. You mentioned before these emerging 21st century institutions.
Yeah.
Things like cities, universities, and guilds. I would say that if people aren't aware, there are many, many libertarian projects that are seeking to build literal city states, special economic zones, and so on. That's a kind of clear, identifiable development of the internet. There's also universities where you can either watch the archive of Harvard or Yale or what have you. You can pay for master classes. You can pay for an education online, various examples of that. The Guild is a little bit more abstract. As a World of Warcraft gamer, I'm quite familiar, but how would you describe this 21st century institution of the Guild?
I think in this current moment, it has been a longstanding desire of conservative politicians and thinkers to want to shrink the state to as small as possible, to enable as much private freedom as they can.
Right.
The second election of Trump, largely supported by crypto money, is really an apex of this longstanding desire to dismantle the state, because the conservative project has always been to have as small a state as possible, so small you can drown it in the bathtub, as Grover Norquist said. And then crypto ultimately wants to delegitimize the state. That's like the founding Satoshi paper of Bitcoin. Yeah. It's like, you know, we can't let this happen. And really wanting to replace it with new types of states, crypto states, internet-based states, states based on how much you own of an asset. We're at a place now where I think that there is a intentional project to delegitimize and to dismantle the government down to really being three functions, like government as priest, government as police, government as censor. And those are the states, those are the actions of the government that I think the current power structure wishes to maintain.
Would you add under police upholding and enforcing contracts? Because that's a classic libertarian definition.
I mean, business goals are definitely driving those things. Yeah. So yes, I would say that would be the case. And then everything else is just trying to dismantle and just push people to their own devices. And the multinational corporation was really the first project to do this. If you look at the growth of Exxon out of Standard Oil and, you know, just this Leviathan that is beyond any government, that's a model for, I think, what this future of social membership and belonging looks like, according to the people who are pursuing these goals. And so there will be the creation of physical city states, but I think there will also be the creation of online networks where you might qualify by having certain social status levels or demonstrating a certain desirability to be in group. And I think that's kind of the Guild of the future, of you qualify based on your likes or based on your status or based on, you know, something you do online, and that will give you membership to groups. And within those memberships of groups will be maybe certain rights and statuses that we think is coming from government now, but that actually be derived from,
I see,
because you're a member of Melania Coin or whatever
it
is.
Right.
And the ultimate outcome of that is going to be to turn the public state into as small a thing as possible, where only people not desired by private states will be left to be supported by the public state. So it's like, you know, urban decay times a million.
Yeah.
Increasingly, people are going to have to sort of fend for themselves using this interconnected network of
Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong.
Yeah, these little guilds, these little things from which we derive different sorts of, you know, pleasures, identities, rights, services. And I think that's the direction that things will go. We've thought of states in the West, we've thought of states for the last several hundred years as being democratic in nature. That is
thought of past tense.
Yes. And now we see capitalism and totalitarianism are not in conflict. They can work quite well together. China is more that model of the future. And, you know, the way corporations are run is probably going to be closer to how these networks are run, which is, I mean, monarchical, if you want to use language some people use. But yeah, more of a command and control structure and people serving a greater need and being able to get pay and services as long as they meet the demands.
This is why I think these conversations about culture are important right now, because coming from this background, you have to do quite a bit of media study. You have to understand how ideas are distributed. And that process that you described of crowdfunding versus the legacy model of film production, for example, I would say that that is happening now to our legacy establishment media news outlets where, sorry to put it this way, but Substack is eating their lunch. And everybody who's steering the ship over there, who's in the newsroom, is plainly, in most cases, just unaware of it. They have your kind of disposition that when you were a critic, you heard this idea and you're like, ah, this is going to outcompete. Potentially, this is going to outcompete my precarious position within the ivory tower. I don't even want to hear about it. And then the thing is built and it's already too late. And so this kind of balkanization, this opening up of the gates that happened to culture, is now happening to news and happening to political positions. This is what we call the expansion of the Overton window.
Yeah.
And that thing is now coalescing, not just from like weird Twitch streams and different content creators and Substack newsletters, but they're distilling into these organized political groups in the real world. And that thing seems to be shaping political reality now.
I mean, I used to be an avid New York Times reader. I'm not a New York Times subscriber anymore, just cooking and games. You know, I read Ezra, I'll read Ezra Klein, the rest I don't really care about, because I'm interested in Ezra Klein, because I've read him since, you know, Wonk Blog, like forever ago.
Right.
But for him, he's like, you know, if he had a Substack, yeah, that would be top of my reading list every time he came in. Mm-hmm. But I just think that that position of cultural voice representing a corporate point of view and is meant to be true with a capital T is just a hard thing for people to really buy into. And if I look at every media organization, whether you're CNN, New York Times, all of these, I think that is the struggle, which is that we are trying to come from a place of this legacy belief in the righteousness of our roles and all of that.
Yeah.
But in this like meta-modern moment where kind of we can all see the strings and the incentives behind everything, and people accept, like, I think the more sophisticated people don't fight those incentives. They just try to acknowledge them and understand what they are, what truths they result in. I think inherently that's what drives people to go towards individual voices and want to spend more time watching you talk to someone for an hour and a half than, you know, hearing Wolf Blitzer talk to me about something.
Have you come across this idea of refragmentation? Have you? This was, I never remember the name of the essay, but it was sent to me by, I think, the first of my friends. I got like really red-pilled and was one of our peer group and then literally went to work for Urbit. But it always sticks with me because I think he was right about this idea that the period in which media was relatively more condensed, where you think of this, let's say like post-war period where there's what, like a dozen media channels. And I don't know, I think you got to shovel coal into the TV to start it up or whatever. There's only 12 different identities that you can have. Cable then gives you 50 different possible identities that you got a sci-fi channel person, you got an Animal Planet person, you got the Fox News person. And then satellite gives you 1,000. The internet gives you millions or billions of them. And his argument was actually that this is a process of refragmentation that is going back to the norm.
Yeah.
It's not that the post-war period where media was relatively constrained was the norm, that if you look back a little bit further than that, there were regional magazines, regional religious sects, regional social institutions. These things were very different from each other, where someone who lived in Nevada, for example, would maybe be geographically close to California, but they'd have entirely different lives, value systems, different dialects even. And so what the internet is doing now is actually bringing us back to that norm, which looks a lot more federated and niche and kind of like broken up different patchwork of
Absolutely.
Cultural identities.
Absolutely. Like Eric Hobsbawm writes a lot about this, that in if you look at the state of media, media is a big word for it, but you know, post-French Revolution in England and in France, you know, you would see 10,000 different newspapers in like London
right,
or something.
And, right.
and none of them would have more than like 5,000 readers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, there just were all these micro points of view related to the very specific lived experiences that those people came from. Cold War media, we have to remember, is all existing within the framework of capitalism trying to outperform communism.
Yeah.
And all information being shaped, you know, by the rules and the social expectations of that competition. And so it appears to be a simpler time, and we ought to share it understanding, but it's just that the macro conditions were so pressurized and were being so tightly controlled by the state, by states, multiple states, that there was a conformity that was extreme that led to, for me growing up, very black and white ideas about the world that the internet has just exploded in ways that have been deeply uncomfortable and threatening to different groups at different times.
Right.
You know, at first it felt like for liberals that the internet validated us. You know, I remember a George Packer piece in The New Yorker once writing about, like, in the 2000s, liberals were right about every issue and yet lost them all, which is kind of true. A lot of things, but like, but then conservatives came to feel that way in the 2010s.
Right.
Hey, there are a lot of things that we think it's wrong, and, you know, but yet we're powerless to do it. And so I think that is a greater truth. It is not a more orderly world, but it is a more truthful one. Just the trust I put, sorry to be metaphysical, but the trust I put in the oneness of the universe and the energy that flows around and through all of us just says it's all true. And to deny the truth is worse than seeing the truth, witnessing the truth, reckoning with the truth. And that leads to uncomfortable places. Ultimately, I think that leads to truth.
You're writing a piece about the origins of creativity, but it has a, I think, very unusual, unexpected origin for that word.
Creativity is the most universal trait there is to us today. Bizarrely, surprisingly, the word and concept are very recent inventions. And you can trace the invention of creativity to a specific time and place, and it was late 1940s, post-war America, where the Department of Defense and the leaders of American government and different social institutions felt that America faced a crisis after the war. There were two fronts. Number one was the crisis of competition with the Soviet Union. And there was a concern that the conformity and the huge amount of resources that the Soviet Union possessed would allow it to outcompete the United States. So there became a lot of studies within the Defense Department of what are ways that we can outperform, you know, what's our edge? How do we win that battle? There was also a widespread concern showing up in a lot of public polling and a lot of literature, things like A One-Dimensional Man by Marcuse. But this idea that for the first time, there were more white-collar workers than blue-collar workers in America, and corporate capitalism was becoming a real thing, and people were unhappy. People were wildly unhappy. There was materialism, there was suburbs, all these things, but yet people could— it just showed up that people were not happy about what was going on. That was also seen as a grave threat to the future of America. And so the Defense Department started giving grants to different social scientists and different people to, like, what do we do about this? And they found a few things. Number one, they found that all the big advances that had happened in the military or, like, technologically had come from divergent thinkers. You know, this was a time of mass conformity in America, but people who, like, didn't do that, they kept saying, like, those people are really valuable. And whereas before the military mindset had been, you know, force conformity, it became that along with find the divergent people and pull them out and empower them. Like, that's the way forward. So they started studying divergent type of people. And a lot of those were artists. Who had an individuating voice, an individual voice they could apply to a task. And they tried to understand how these people worked. And they studied all these divergent people, like measuring their brain waves, trying to find what is it that you do?
Okay.
You know, like true scientific study. And in the end, they came up with a phrase, a concept to describe what it is that these people possessed. And also what they came to see is the path out of people being unhappy in their lives. And that was the idea of creativity. Creativity was seen as a democratic form of genius. A way you could take the essence of the artist, who before was like the wild person left on their own, and say, take that essence of like striving for perfection or making something your own, and instead teaching that as like a trait that is inherent in everybody.
Hmm.
And that creativity is actually like the driving force of all of human life. This is constant desire to self-improve, to individuate yourself even more. The very first creativity studies researchers were people like Abraham Maslow, Timothy Leary.
Oh, wow.
And they were trying to discover, yeah, what is it to be? What is it to be different? What does it take? How do we create a society like that? And so the word creativity entered the dictionary for the first time in 1966.
Wow.
And a bill in 1968, the education system was remade to push creative thinking into schools. So things like creative writing, teaching people to write essays rather than just sentence structures, art programs, all of those things entered schools for the very first time in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, and have grown since, all with an explicit goal of developing more individual voices, more divergent thinking, that essence of genius in everybody. And this is a long-term view plan from the Defense Department in the 1940s and 50s that is outrageously successful.
I mean, this is just further confirmation that the 68 counterculture was a deep state psyop, which I've believed for a very long time. I have this idea, I'm pretty sure that this is correct, and I used to be very resentful about it before, but I would imagine artists as like these utopian visionaries who, you know, could imagine the new society, that they would be leading the way. And I feel like in the 2010s, that mantle was kind of taken by the tech pitch, in that these like visionary platforms were remaking society. And I used to think of, oh, this is a social failure in that artists were supposed to be leading the way and the people who ran the tech companies were, they were taking our game. Like, that doesn't belong to them. But now I think about this in a serious way, in that platforms do much more meaningfully shape the culture than any individual artist. And so building those new institutional frameworks or platform frameworks is actually really, really influential. And a lot of people I know who started out in the world of art then started to write literal policy papers for platforms or to build platforms themselves in some cases.
I think entrepreneurs are more free than artists today, especially capital A artists.
Where like people who show in galleries and museums.
Yeah, where there's such a social conformity and set of expectations that you're meant to reach. And
right.
Certain tools you're allowed to use and not allowed to use.
Right.
And
right.
It's a polite, polite society. Actually polite, but polite society. And entrepreneurship is, you build the plane while you fly it.
Wild West.
You never know where it's going to go. And it's just unbridled, go do it. And I mean, I know which of those sounds more fun to be a part of. I mean, I've certainly felt it. There's an uncontrolled burn tearing down existing institutions right now.
Right.
A lot of which because they were born in this earlier context of established fact, of really the individualist lifestyle or certain nationalist sort of way of thinking, that they're just not equipped. They feel untruthful. They feel so distant from life as we know it today. And I think the number of institutions that are alive right now at this moment of speaking and how many of them are alive 10 years from now, I think that survival rate might be much lower than we think. Mm. At the same time that that is happening, our experiences on the web, the tools and norms that are emerging on the web are pushing us to create our own institutions. Institutions is the wrong word, but our own groups, our own shared meaning that is more truthful because it's more connected to what people actually feel today and is built on the rails and the values of the world as it exists now and will exist in the future compared to what it's been. Like, to show even how big a difference, like, previous world, maybe nothing was more sacrosanct than like one person, one vote.
Right.
Apologies if you're a woman or not a landowner or, you know, at different periods of time. But say since the 1970s, one person, one vote. On the internet, you know, it's like one identity, one vote, one alt, one vote, one, like the notion of how you define a personhood or even the importance of defining personhood. It's just so different. The assumptions are just so, so different. And I trust where people are, you know, organically finding themselves, where their experiences are leading them to say, you know what, I would rather be a member of this Discord, you know, with these other 800 people who maybe we all own the same shitcoin, maybe we all read the same newsletter, maybe, you know, who knows for whatever reasons. But those are spaces built for the present and the future. And I think the institutions that are going to define the world as our children will know it are happening there. And, you know, the top one or two players in each category, institutional category, you know, they'll survive because things die slower than you think and whatever. I mean, that it's hard to displace, you know, brand. Very hard to displace a strong brand. But the energy is shifting. And we're going to find how far can we go in legitimizing, self-legitimizing the things we do on the web. In many cases, we don't care. But as we start to like wish to be economic actors, or maybe wish to have certain legal rights, or, you know, define in more precise ways what it means to belong or not belong, those systems will intersect with the world that exists now, or the, you know, the regimes of that exists in the past. There will be another break, you know, some more conflict. And I think the future will be written again by what the 300 people are doing in a Discord. That, because that is a more truthful reflection of how things are now. And for me, you know, being a music writer, music critic, like all I wanted was to write for whatever, the New York Times or some big outlet,
right?
You know, 20 years ago. Now I have zero desire to do that. Now publishing in my own space is like on my own blog means more to me than appearing in a space like that, because I don't know, it somehow feels more truthful. It feels more aligned with the culture and values as I see them, as a consumer of media, you know, what I look for and feel. And so I would place every bet on the things that are just natively happening now. And for reasons, some reasons that I like, some reasons that are hugely distasteful or offensive to me. But there's a truth in the energy that's driving them. And I think that the truth of that energy is irrepressible, and it's just going to keep lighting a fire everywhere.
Yancy, thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it.